Welcome to Canusa Street, a podcast at the intersection of the issues and policies between Canada and the United States. Here are your hosts, Beth Burke and Chris Sands.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to Canusa Street. I'm Beth Burke with the Canadian American Business Council, joined by my ever fabulous co-host, Christopher Sands of the Woodrow Wilson Center.
Hi, Beth. I'm not sure I'm fabulous, but I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to see you, and I'm really excited about our guest today.
Yes.
We are fortunate to have a premier with us.
Yes, one who's come from away.
Well played.
Well played indeed.
Our guest today is Premier Andrew Fury, and he is Newfoundland and Labrador's premier. I'll tell you a joke about that later, sir. But before he was premier, he was a trauma surgeon and has a diverse education, which includes a diploma in organizational leadership from Oxford University and a master's in clinical epidemiology from Memorial University in Newfoundland. He's got a great work ethic. He has been both a politician working at the local and provincial and national levels, all of which have given him awards. But in particular, he's a humanitarian. He and his wife started a charity that has gone as far as Haiti, Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Guatemala, Nicaragua, working on public health issues. So a great person to be with, not just a distinguished person, Premier, but a very great person. So thank you so much for coming to Canusa Street.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, I also have to make a quick plug on the bio because I think there's an important piece we missed. His wife is from the United States, and he spent time in Baltimore when he was practicing or studying.
Absolutely. So an interesting story. My wife did medical school in Canada, and that's where we met. And so distinctly remembering her day one, she said at that time she intended to do 1 year of medical school in Canada and then transfer back to the United States. And she's still there today. But we did have the opportunity to do my trauma fellowship at Shock Trauma and the University of Maryland in Baltimore. We really looked strongly at staying in the United States. It's obviously we have a strong affinity to the place, familial affinity for the place. But I just have a deep and solid admiration for the country and the people in it, and what the country has been able to accomplish in terms of its contribution to the global society and democracy in general is absolutely phenomenal. And of course, my kids are dual citizens. So my eldest was actually born in Baltimore during my surgical training.
That's so fun.
So Canusa Street just runs right through your household.
Runs right through.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah,
and we celebrate American Thanksgiving. So.
Oh, that's
no
very,
matter where
important.
We are in the world,
very important.
No matter where we are in the world, we celebrate American Thanksgiving.
Well, we share that holiday, but it's just nice to have it on a Thursday and a 4-day weekend, I always feel, in November.
That's brilliant.
Canadian Thanksgiving is nice too, it's a Monday, so it doesn't have the same.
And it really kicks off the Christmas season.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Well, Premier, you've epitomized this. I made a joke about Come From Away when I introduced you because many Americans know the musical Come From Away big hit, and it had a connection to Newfoundland. A lot of people fell in love with the place, but for our listeners, how accurate is that? And 20 years on, are people still as warm and welcoming? And does that still resonate with the Newfoundland
It absolutely does. What happened during 9/11 and the town of Gander and the surrounding communities opening up their homes for stranded passengers in central Newfoundland after that terrible, terrible terrorist attack is really symbolic of who we are as Newfoundlanders and Labradorians and have always been. So there are very distinct moments of history in which that pattern of behavior to foreigners has been on full display. So while that was a particularly troubling moment in history and a unique moment in time for those passengers and for the world, really, there are plenty of examples throughout our history where we have done that. I mean, we're an island in the middle of the North Atlantic, so we are not we're no stranger to nautical disasters. Some of which, by the way, off our coast, we've helped U.S. vessels and opened our rural communities, coastal communities, taken in naval vessels that have hit the rocks and cared for people in their homes because there's no hospitals. And that lives on today. So while the spirit of Come From Away, the beauty of Come From Away is it actually truly captures the spirit of what it means to be a Newfoundlander and Labradorian. And that still lives on today, even during the most recent geopolitical issue with Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. Newfoundland and Labrador, under our government, sent over the first Canadian plane. It wasn't a Team Canada plane. It was a plane from Newfoundland and Labrador to take displaced Ukrainians from Poland into Newfoundland and Labrador. Yeah. And a large, some of those people were welcomed into people's homes. They lived in people's homes throughout the province. So it is, you hear about the spirit of Newfoundlanders and Labradorians mm-hmm. and how generous and welcoming they are. We're known for, you know, tourists come for the vistas and the incredible hikes and the ocean scenery and the icebergs, but they really come back because they're attracted to the magnetic essence that is the spirit of Newfoundlander and Newfoundlanders and Labradorians.
Amazing.
Yeah, well, you touched briefly on the beauty of your province. You know, I think it is something that is so important and so vital to bring people to come visit. And, you know, can you speak a little bit about tourism and bringing people across? And
yeah, sure. So we tourism is a big industry for us. It's seasonal, but it's growing in what I like to call the bookends of the season. As interest continues to grow for people to visit Newfoundland and Labrador. We've often found it's a bucket list destination. People are attracted, you know, the mystique and the history of the Titanic, and which went down off our shores, icebergs in general, the rugged coastline, the immense hiking trails, and just the openness of the landscape. It's very rugged. It's a kind of a combination of Iceland, England, and then, you know, the more tempered maritime provinces. And the beauty, or one of the most special things of Newfoundland and Labrador is it's gigantic, right? It'd be the fourth, I think it'd be the fourth largest state. It's three times the landmass of the maritime provinces, the other three Atlantic provinces combined. So it's quite large and has, as a result, has a diversity of tourism products. We're on the East Coast and the Northeast Coast. You have the very traditional fishing village, what someone imagined is still captured, by the way, in the mystique of the 17, 1800s. And then you have different landscapes on the west coast with giant fjords and unique geological formations. And then the whole mainland portion of the province in Labrador, which is just truly untapped beauty, where you start to touch the Arctic Circle and have the... and throughout all that, of course, is there's a true indigenous experience to be had as well. It is... It's a special place. I encourage everybody to come.
I know. I think we should do a remote taping there for Canusa Street.
Canusa Street on the road.
Exactly.
And it's a lot of fun. Like, you know, it's a lot of fun. People have a lot of fun there. We're very welcoming people, full of entertainers and storytellers. And I always say on the national stage, we bat far above our weight. We're disproportionately represented in the entertainment industry across the country, and you'll experience that firsthand. The live music, no offense to anybody else, but the live music that you can just stumble into a pub and see and listen to and take in is world class on any night of the week in the middle of the summer.
That's fantastic. Now, I know Labrador... So the Newfoundland's the island, Labrador is on the continental side, but I know it's also been a great source of energy. And
when
I do think of energy a lot of times with Newfoundland. When I was younger, it was all about Hibernia, the offshore oil.
Still important.
Which is still important, but I also know hydroelectric dams in the region, and they're a long way from the United States, and yet you find ways to get some of that electricity closer to the rest of Canada. How do you do it? I know Hydro-Québec is one of your not always...
They're not a celebrated partner right now. No, but
and to explain that to listeners, Hydro-Québec would carry the energy, Newfoundland's electricity at a rate that was set a long time ago and not adjusted, a fixed rate. Yeah. So I think a lot of people in Newfoundland feel that they should get a more market rate for that. I only say that just because I know that's an in joke.
Well, let's finish the context,
please.
Because there was a deal that was done in the 1960s and with no escalators and no contemplation for any energy crisis. prices or even increasing in electricity rates. So currently we have a 5,400 megawatt project that was developed in the 60s that represents 15% of Hydro-Québec's firm electrical capacity, a large portion of which is distributed in the northeastern seaboard and in New England states. Currently, we sell at a 0.2 cents, not 2 cents, 0.2 cent kilowatt hours to Quebec, and Quebec, Hydro-Québec sells it, for example, in Vermont at 20 cent kilowatt hours. So there is a reason that Newfoundlanders and Labradorians are upset at that deal. Mm-hmm. But that said, that deal expires in 2041, which in utility terms is today. There's no one really building dams or nuclear projects, the equivalent of 5,400 megawatts in a 10 to 20 year horizon. That would be a remarkable achievement in the current current environment when you consider Indigenous relationships, environmental assessments, and so we're hopeful that Quebec recognizes that that now is the time to potentially reconsider. That said, in the political, sorry, we've gone down a rabbit hole now, but in the political context, you know, we want what's best for Newfoundland and Labrador.
Sure.
And because it's not just the hydroelectric capacity that exists in Labrador, and there, like I said, there's 5,400 megawatts that is being developed, that has been developed and is running smoothly. Mm-hmm. There is currently about 4,400 megawatts that exists that hasn't been developed. The only remaining large-scale hydroelectric project in North America exists within Labrador. So we see an incredible opportunity for Newfoundland and Labrador, but also for not just citizens of Canada, but citizens of the United States. We're in a very enviable position in that we can use some of that power, especially when it comes to the critical mineral piece. Or, by the way, I think, you know, a green or low carbon steel is an important, often neglected conversation in the critical mineral piece, because you can't make windmills, you can't do some of the green transition that we're all very hungry to do without steel. So we have in Labrador, for example, a very high purity iron that it coexists next to hydroelectric capacity, and all of a sudden then you have a green extraction formula, which is the first step towards green steel, obviously. All that said is we contemplate and look at the energy space as a net exporter, obviously. And one that we want to make sure that we're getting the best deal, not just for us and the future industrial developments, whether it's processing iron or other nickel, yeah, other commodities that exist, rare earths that exist within Newfoundland and Labrador, or exporting it. And it's a unique position for us. It's a great position for us to be in, I think, especially given the energy deficit that Hydro-Québec talks publicly about, by the way.
And yeah, it's about that.
They're talking about having to invest $185 billion in the next 10 to 20 years. And that, I think, probably assumes that they have 15% coming from Newfoundland and Labrador. But we think it's very exciting for us. And it's not just on the hydroelectric piece. We're an island in the middle of the North Atlantic. Our portion of us is an island in the middle, which has really high, consistent wind speeds. And our problem has always been, whether it's fish, minerals, technology, we've always known that we've had resources, but because of the global constraints and supply chain and economics of export, being an island in the middle of the North Atlantic is one of the reasons that we had to relinquish our independence in the first place and join Canada in 1949. But the times have changed, and so whether it's using the wind to create hydrogen to export through ammonia to around the world, to Europe or the northeastern seaboard, or to industrial players in the mineral space, or exporting hydroelectric capacity electrons through what used to be non-economical or viable projects, has suddenly shifted, and we find ourselves in a great position to be not just energy leaders in Canada, but energy leaders in North America. And it's part of what's so great about having a forum like this and having these discussions. Sometimes the United States don't pay attention, and it's not that you should. You flick the light switch, who knows where the electrons come from.
True.
And there's always been a reliable supply. We think that we can have an even greater role to play moving forward in the green, what is an important transition because we are principally exporters.
Mm-hmm. And to that point, I think another thing that's pretty interesting, and maybe not, maybe our listeners are savvy enough to know this, but I think there's a lot of people in the United States who don't fully appreciate that the provinces control their resources. So you yeah. being able to share your story about the resources that you control is really important.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as you know, the Canadian Constitution rightfully or definitively lays out provincial jurisdiction over natural resources, which is different than some other countries, obviously, which is why I think it's important for us to be here today. It's important for us to have these conversations and dialogue such that people understand that premiers, different perhaps than governors, have jurisdiction, and it's our product to sell. And while I fully get it, Minister Wilkinson, for example, Minister Champagne, Minister Ying, the Prime Minister himself, good friends of mine, they're great people and good salespeople, but they can't sell what we have. We have to sell what we have. Right. And that's, in my opinion, part of the beauty of the Federation, part of the beauty of the Confederation that is Canada. And respecting those lines, respecting what was rightfully set out in the Constitution is important to ensuring a healthy country of Canada moving forward, given the geographical and resource constraints that exist within our own country.
Absolutely. And given all of the conversation around resource development and transition, I'm assuming this means we're going to get to see you a lot more down
here in D.C.
That's
the idea. That's yeah. the idea. As you've heard me say already today, just in casual conversation, it might have been a blind spot for me just because of my personal relationship and attachment to the United States. And to be fair to me, even in the first couple of years of my tenure, we were restricted because of COVID. But we've done a good job, I think, in ensuring that the Germans and people throughout Europe and the UK and even in the Middle East understand the energy space that we have and the opportunity that we have, not just for them, but for their investors and capital that is looking to be deployed in mega projects. But we need to do a better job. I need to do a better job of making sure that story is known south of the border. And again, forums like this and are very important. I know we talked briefly at the New England Governor Eastern Premier's meeting, mm-hmm. and that was also those are important conversations to have, because there are aha moments where, you know, you're sitting with a governor and they don't realize the source of the electricity and the contract duration and the impacts that could potentially have on their own, you know, domestic and industrial agendas.
This comes back to a theme I always have. There's a bookstore in Canada that likes to say the world needs more Canada. And I always feel it's different when the outside world tells you that, because, you know, it means we really do. You mentioned Europe, other places where we don't know where some of our resources are going to come from now, particularly with all the geopolitics. Taking a step back from that, maybe, to some of the countries that are really suffering that I think also need more Canada. I want to pull out a part of your biography, which is in the introduction, but really strikes me as amazing, which as a physician, you and your wife got involved in helping countries in crisis. And the first big one was Haiti. And yeah. even today, I'm sorry to say, still such a crisis. And you've been there, you've been Bangladesh, you've been Guatemala, Ethiopia, Nicaragua, so many places. Talk a little bit about that aspect, because I think there are a lot of people who say, okay, I've got mine, my little corner of the world's not so bad. But to have that compassion to actually go far afield and connect with people in that way, it's not easy. Not everyone would do it.
No.
but from your perspective, how did that change you, and how did that change your perception of the world in which we're living these days?
Oh, well, I think it was formative in my opinion of our place in the world, not just in terms of a country or a province, but our place in the world as an individual. And mm-hmm. And that, you know, individuals can have an immense impact on other individuals. We're global citizens. I truly believe that. And I think that we all won the lottery by being born in the United States or Canada. And it's pure luck.
Yep.
You know, we all like to think that we create our own path in the world, but we started with a distinct advantage being born in one of these two countries. So I always, not always, it wasn't part of my dinner conversation growing up. None of my parents didn't do this. I didn't know one of my family did this, but I was so changed so impacted by and changed as a person by my experience in Haiti that we wanted to do more. And then as a strategy, created a new team to continue to build on that, never knowing what it was going to turn out to be, what it was. And, you know, growing from a single team that was providing medical relief to building hospitals, establishing curriculum, growing in education, and then growing, by the way, there's teams from University of Massachusetts going under our banner now, or what used to be our banner. I'm not involved anymore. But it really helped me see outside the, and I say this now even in some political speeches, is every now and then we get so trapped in the day-to-day. Sometimes you need to do yourself a favor and look up away from X or the Twitter or Facebook or whatever, or the rolling headlines, and look more broadly towards the horizon, because people will remember us as political leaders after all the smoke settles and the fog lifts by how much we have, not necessarily by the day-to-day issues. Right. They're gonna measure us by how much we've helped change the system for a more sustainable system for the future. So they're gonna, and I think to come back to your question, that using my experience and the challenges that exist in those countries, number one, made me feel like there's no challenge that's too big. because we could have stopped. I could have stopped at any particular moment in time. There is an issue with every single thing you do, and if you're going to be beat down by a single barrier, then you might as well not start. But number two, really made me a better surgeon. because you're operating under constraints. Definitely made me a better and more caring a physician in general, and a better husband, a better father, and a better dad, as a better person as a result of all of this. And I think, but the overall message, and one that I could leave to anybody, is the day-to-day echo chamber is important. You can't take your eye off what's important on a day-to-day basis and be just, but you do need, it is healthy for you, it's healthy for any organization to look towards the horizon and not take your eye off that.
Well, I know you're not involved in the organization, but everybody's selling something. Tell us about the organization. Give us the name.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
Your book.
Yeah, no. It's called Team Broken Earth, and just to tell you how, that it was never supposed to be anything. Like we put a name on it. I felt people would want to be a part of something, so we put, because it was only supposed to be one trip to Port-au-Prince. The backstory is that I went with a group from Baltimore, from Hopkins and Maryland, right after the earthquake, and we went for a week or 10 days or whatever it was, and there was some inefficiency in that because you were mixed and matched with people from different from different hospitals, and so, you have some trust in your anesthesiologist, but it's going to take you 3 or 4 days to know if he or she can do what they say they can do. Equally, they have to build up trust with you as a surgeon, and so there's inefficiency there. So the aha moment for me at that point was, well, why don't I just take everybody that I work with in the operating room at home and move them down there? It's just a few plane tickets. How hard can it be? And I didn't think
famous last words,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So we went once, and we called it Team Broken Earth. And then before I got home, even on the plane, on the ride home, my BlackBerry at the time was all lit up with, this best experience we've ever had. When can we do it again? And then it truly, in an organic way, spread across the country. And when it started to spread, I thought, because, there is a bit of an inferiority complex that exists within Newfoundland and Labrador. We're the newest province, even though we're the oldest oldest settlement in North America. We're the newest province. We, unfortunately, were the butt of many jokes over the years. Glad to say that's not true anymore, but there is a bit of an inferiority complex that exists. So I thought, the University of Calgary or the University of British Columbia look at this and say, okay, it's a cool idea. We'll just do it and do it ourselves. But the kind of special thing that happened was everybody was just happy to be a part of what we created and not make it their own. And so that organization lives on. They were in Guatemala last week doing a cleft lip and palate mission. It's expanded well beyond orthopedic surgery. People are doing urological procedures. We recognized very early on, I did, that I don't have any women's health training, obviously, but that is such an immense need and can have such a direct impact on the population very quickly. So we created a women's health education course that we put off several times in downtown Bangladesh. And the feedback was, you know, this will change people's practices immediately. And they have one of the highest birth rates and fertility rates in the entire world, right? So all of these things make it a very the special organization. It is not top heavy. It is very flat. And I think that makes it work so that when we have a team from the University of Massachusetts, it's their team. Like, we don't tell them, you know, you need this complement of people. Mm-hmm. The team from UMass, for example, wanted to do hernias. Great. It's a great operation to be able to do, actually, in a developing country, low and middle-income country, because it's a great return on investment in terms of not just the operation itself, but the returning people to work. So we don't we give them the model. We give them the support, but we want it to be your experience and not ours. And I've never had anybody who led a team to come back and say, no, that'll be the last time. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Well, and you wrote a book about it. So yeah, our listeners may want to pick that up. I know it's available on Amazon and other platforms.
Yeah, it feels weird to pitch a book, but it's called Hope in the Balance. And it's about Team Broken Earth, the inception, and really the intersection of my own family history, the history of Newfoundland and Labrador, the history of Haiti, and then the evolution of Broken Earth.
Well, I have to say, Beth, you know I'm kind of a nerd, so I've read it. I do think a lot of our listeners will enjoy it. It's been wonderful just sitting with you and getting a sense of the person, not only the person, but the place that you represent.
Yeah.
And you're so fortunate.
I pinch myself every day. It's truly a magical place that is unique in its historical context. It's unique in its social context. Mm-hmm. It's such a fun place to live and raise a family, and you rarely hear anybody say that they don't want to go back if they've gone as a tourist. And we're growing the population in leaps and bounds. So anyone who's out there who wants to try to come and set up Newfoundland and Labrador as their new home, you'd certainly be welcomed.
Well, thank you so much. It really has been such a pleasure having you here and spending time getting to learn about you and Newfoundland and Labrador. It's wonderful. Really appreciate it. Canusa Street's coming.
Oh, yeah. You're welcome. Yeah. You can kiss the cod and do some screech.
It'll be perfect. Yes.
That will be wonderful. Yeah. Thank you very much, Bremer. Come back again soon.
Thanks very much.
This podcast is brought to you by the Canadian American Business Council and the Wilson Center. If you like this episode, help others find our show and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.